It's December 2nd, 2021, and it is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, who is really, guy is so smart and has such good insight into his own character, and it's always a pleasure to hear Mike L.
Hello, La Cañada, and everybody. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Randall. Thank you, Pat. All the people making this Zoom bus move. Oh, boy. Very grateful to be with you tonight. I have to remind myself, but I'll say it out loud in case it's helpful to you too, of a few things. One is I am not here to make Al-Anon look good to anybody. I'm just here to tell you how it is for me, and let you decide if you're new, if maybe there's a hint of something that you think might be useful to you here. We certainly hope that there is if you're new, so welcome. Not here to say anything brilliant or smart. I'm not here to impress. I'm here to connect. I'm here to connect. And it's not about the words so much. Even through this virtual interface, it's just so important to me, to my well-being and my recovery, to be connected to you folks. And I've got you in gallery view so I can see you, and I'm doing my best not to. Sometimes on Zoom, my eyes roll back into back of my head like I'm Linda Blair or something, and I just go into a trance state. And I'm going to attempt to resist that inclination and look at you. You know, we mentioned in our one of our opening readings that most meetings will read something called the loving interchange of help among members. And that's what I'm really aware of tonight, big time. Just seeing you reminds me, I can feel in my body that you all are here and are present. That said, if anyone has an inclination to check out Facebook or your bank account or anything, you know, online while I'm talking, which I know no one would ever do such a thing, certainly not me. But if you do, you know, there's some good websites to try out, like itsallyourfault.com is a good one, or whyme.org. That's one of my favorites. universityofwesternmartyrdom.edu. So just in case you just decide you need to do a little virtual wandering, those are my suggestions. I'm a glib motherfucker. Okay. So like I said, I'm glad to be with you. What I plan to do, I don't really know. I'm going to turn on a timer here so that I know what I'm doing. Hold on, apps and timer and 7:28. Pat, do you have a rough idea how many minutes I should pop into this thing?
You should have 40 to 45 minutes.
Okay, I'll hit 40 and we'll
and,
see.
And I'm not sure who our official timer is.
Is that Eric? Cool.
Okay, I got Eric with a K.
Yeah, just hit me up at 40, Eric. I got something going here on my screen too, so hopefully.
All right, I'll do that.
I'll be mindful. Thanks. Yeah, so I thought I would talk to you about where I come from in terms of alcoholism and my its place in my life, my place in it, in the disease. And I'll tell you how I got here, which is just my favorite, one of my favorite stories to tell of all time. And then maybe if there's still time, you know, I'll just tell you how the program is working me today. Okay, so spoiler alert, I didn't come because I needed this program early. I could have been in Alice, but I grew up in alcoholism. My father was a very, very, very severe alcoholic. and my mother. I love them both, but I also have other feelings towards them too that I've learned through the program to allow myself to have, not to live in, not to move into, not to make a career of, but to allow. But just speaking of the positives, they were great people, my mother and my father. They were both traumatized themselves from their own early adult and childhood experiences. And my father's way of, one of the ways of that I think he managed that was to self-medicate with copious amounts of alcohol. His drink of choice, I don't know if this is a trigger for any AAs, but it's he drank Cutty Sark scotch. And he was drunk almost all the time. He would hide his Cutty's, the fifths, those little bottles. He would hide those bottles out in the garage behind rafters, inside tool chests, things like that. And I think that affected me more than the drunkenness, actually, because it was like he had a secret. And it was not a very well-kept secret. We all knew that he was drunk all the time. We all knew that the Cutty Sark was in the garage. But there was shame around it for him, obviously, or he would have just had it in the living room. And sometimes when I'm overthinking, which is one of my favorite hobbies, I think that maybe it was the shame I picked up from him without meaning to, and certainly without his meaning to pass that on to me. Anyway, that was my dad. My mom was a quintessential, you could call her, you could use the term untreated Al-Anon. She made it very clear to me and to my older sister that my dad was the problem and his drinking was the problem. And we had this family mythology that one day my dad was going to get this big promotion at his job. He worked as a salesman for an auto parts supplier in downtown LA. And his boss had a big mansion in Bel Air. And we lived only a couple of miles away. But in terms of economic disparity, we might as well have been at the North Pole. It was very different. And I mention this because, you know, our literature says the alcoholics don't seem to care about the bills, among other things, the bills. So it tells me that money issues often intersect with the family disease of alcoholism. So we had this mythology that he was going to get this promotion from, that's the name of his boss. And when that happened, and it was going to happen anytime soon, because he had been promised this thing for a long time. And when that happened, we were going to move from this side of the San Diego freeway, where the regular folks lived. Never mind that really, it was a pretty tony place in itself, but I didn't know that because my parents always told us how poor we were. But we were going to move up and over that big freeway, and we were going to get onto this side where the happy people lived. And yeah, that was what we were waiting for. I had an older sister. I coped with alcoholism by becoming the good boy. I had a severe case of good boyism. So I was happy all the time. And I was getting straight A's all the time. And I always was putting on a brave front to everybody, including to myself. And I took it on myself to be evidence to the outside world, the neighbors, for example, that they didn't have to worry about the yelling they heard the night before coming from our house or things clanging against the walls or whatever. Pay no attention to what your senses are telling you. Look at me. I'm thriving. I'm getting straight A's. I have a smile on my face. So I sort of became the mascot for the family to make it look like things were okay. And I didn't learn till much later that the harm that did to me, because I was believing my own hype. And I was burying a lot of feelings I didn't want to be identified with. Anyway, I was the good boy is the short version of that story. And my sister was the opposite. Her way of coping with the chaos that was our home, there was fighting all the time. All the time. It seemed like there probably were times when it wasn't there, but it seemed like it was always anger and fighting going on. Not with me, though, because I was a good boy. So I never got mad at anybody and nobody ever got mad at me. My sister acted out the other way. She became the problem child. As she got older, there were problems with the law. She was kicked out of several schools, drug abuse, all kinds of stuff. But, you know, on the surface, she and I are wildly different. But you know what? On the inside, I can't speak for her, but I have a suspicion. As my dear friend Michael says, I have come to suspect that she and I kind of have the same ism. And it has to do with the hating of self that comes from growing up in alcoholism. It's a killer. It's a killer. And, you know, I was just handling mine in my way and she was handling hers in her way. So that's what I came from. At the same time, I was sent to a school that was run by people. It was a religious school. It wasn't heavy duty on the religion, but to go there, you had to belong to this religion. And the religion I loved, it was a very metaphysical, so-called spiritual religion that taught that you could heal yourself of any condition, physical, mental, or spiritual, and anyone else, by thinking the right thoughts about God. And I loved that. And the more chaos I was feeling at home, the more I grabbed onto that religion for all it was worth. And I really became convinced that all my problems were the result of flawed thinking, and that my job was to straighten out that thinking, find the right thoughts and think them, and then things would pan out okay. So I became, at a very early age, I developed a huge faith in the power of my intellect. I'll just fast forward because I don't want to forget to say it later. When I came into Al-Anon, my first sponsor, Peter Brager in New York, told me that he gave me a line from the AA literature, from the 12 and 12 from AA that I love. And excuse me for veering a little bit off of our conference approved, but this is so good on step one. It says, who cares to admit? Oh, wait, that's the one. That's a different one. That's a good one, too. No, this is the quote from Bill W. We truly believed that this is describing what it was like before program. We truly believed that our intellect, backed by will, was sufficient to rightly guide our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world. That just describes me not only as an adult, but even as a kid. I wanted to rightly guide my inner life, and I thought it was my job to do that. And I thought the tool I had to do that with was my intellect. And I tried. You know, step one is admitted we were powerless, but step zero precedes step one for me. And my step zero was we kept on trying, God damn it. We kept on trying to fix ourselves with our thinking, failing over and over again, but sure, every time that the next thinkathon, we would find the magic thought and we would be able to like ourselves at last. That was my step zero. So let's see what else. I just don't want to leave any salient points out, but that's how I grew up. When I was 13, my sister had been kicked out of a couple of schools by then, and my dad came home from work hammered, And I remember him standing in the living room, and my mom announced to him and to us that she was divorcing him. And this was in the late 60s. And people that went to the school I went to did not get divorced. Even people in my people in my neighborhood did, but they weren't religious like I was. So I was horrified to find that my mom was divorcing my dad. And he stood there with that glazed look in his eye that he almost always had. And I don't mean to be critical, because he had a lot of joyful qualities as well. I don't want to paint him too dimensionally. But he had that glaze, and he said, he announced that he, that day, had just been fired from his job at this company that was supposed to be his ticket to affluence, so that we could all move over to the other side of the freeway and be happy. So it was kind of a 1-2 gut punch. I developed an illness, which wasn't supposed to happen in my religion. You're not supposed to get sick, because you're supposed to always be thinking the right thoughts about God. And it went on for several months, and they were going to hold me back because I had missed too much school. And my mom took me to a doctor. Thank God she wasn't too devout in that religion. And she took me to a doctor, and the doctors ran all these tests. And this doctor said, it's psychosomatic. He's stressed out, and he needs to go back to school where he has some structure. And they forced me against my will to go back to school. I threatened, as my dad drove me to school, I threatened to jump out of the car. I haven't thought about this before, but I think really what I was desperately trying to do was fix the situation, you know, interrupt it somehow, make the anger stop and make the family a family, which obviously was beyond my powers. Anyway, that was rough. But you know what? I went back to school and I got that structure and I did get better. And I think too, that's a great thing about program too, is that just by the structure of our coming together on a weekly basis, it, for me anyway, it provides this kind of scaffolding that I can use to help me move through life. So that was hard. The family failed, basically. And I didn't do this consciously, but I've learned through some fourth step work and also through some outside help that I thought it was my fault. Not consciously, but I thought there was something really wrong with me, that alcoholism had ravaged our family as much as it had. It had to be me, because I knew if I could think those right thoughts, I could fix it, and I couldn't find the right thoughts. So that takes me up to early adolescence, and I won't go year by year, because we'd be here all night and it's not really important, all of it. But I wanted to give you a taste of the family dynamic that I grew up in, because I became a self-hater, and I had a bad case of it. And I didn't know, I'll move ahead to the coming to Al-Anon in a minute, but I didn't come to Al-Anon to have my self-hate removed, because I didn't think that was possible. I came because I got mad at my partner at the time, and I'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, I moved out of LA, I moved to New York, I pursued a career in theater, and I had a wonderful life in New York. And I thought I had escaped everything, you know, but that damn self, I just couldn't stand the man I was seeing in the mirror every day. And I didn't think it was a problem. I thought the reason I couldn't stand myself was that I had really good taste. And I had no idea that it was connected to alcoholism or anything else. I had heard about Al-Anon. Now I'm in my 20s. I've heard about Al-Anon, but I had a very stereotypical view of what I thought it was. I thought it was a program for married straight women who were living currently with active alcoholic husbands. You know, I like bouffant hairdos, the whole thing. I had this whole stereotype of what an Al-Anon member was supposed to be. Later, when I came back to LA and got in the Saturday morning Woodland Hills meeting, actually a lot of those ladies were there, but I learned that there's those and others who are in the program. So I pushed through life. I muscled through life, and I wasn't all bad. I had a lot of great experiences, but this gnawing feeling of I'm not okay would not leave. And as I said, I kept trying to love myself. Even my freshman comp essay at UCLA, we had to do something about our goals. And I said, I wrote this big long essay. And then at the end, I remember saying, but really my main goal is to learn to love myself. I thought it was my job to learn to love myself, but I couldn't do it. And that's how it was. A decade or two go by, and now I meet a really great guy. I was doing stand-up comedy at the Improv in New York, and I was pretending to be straight because my friend told me that at that time, early 90s, it was dicey being openly gay in the entertainment industry. Closeted, had this closeted stand-up comic life at the Improv, and then when I finished my set, I would go uptown to a bar called The Candle and hang out there and drink and cruise. And I met a really, really nice guy there. And after knowing him a week or so, he told me that his partner had just died of AIDS, and he didn't think he was going to be able to hold on to his apartment. And he was on the verge of this. I've known this guy a week, 1 week. We're having dinner at a Mexican restaurant. And when he tells me that, I say, well, why don't you come live with me? And the words just came out of my mouth. And I remember at the time thinking, who said that? But it was me. It was my mouth anyway. And so he moved in. And you know what? It wasn't so bad. He drank to great excess. I didn't mind it so much because I really liked him. And he wasn't a mean drunk at all. It wasn't that kind of toxic anger, simmering resentment festival that was my childhood. He was a happy drunk. He couldn't hold a job. He would get a job and then he would get fired. And here's what I would do. I would walk up to the job, like one was a restaurant about 3 blocks up the street from us. I went up there and I gave them a piece, the last piece of my mind about how they should not have fired him. I knew nothing about the situation. For all I know, he showed up loaded or he may have stolen from the cash register. It could have been anything. And I went in there and I'm surprised they didn't call the cops on me because I was getting pretty aggressive for a good boy Al-Anon. Anyway, that was our dynamic. I have good friends. We'd go to their house for dinner and then I'd get the phone call the next day. Michael, I'll call him Mr. T. Mr. T stole a bottle of our best wine. It's not here anymore. And here's where I was kind of a natural. I didn't have any program under my belt, but for some reason I said, well, that's something you'll have to take up with him. That's really not about me. So if you have a complaint, just call him. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, one day someone mentioned, Leonard mentioned the Lois and her shoe. I love that story. All of you probably know it, but if anyone's a newcomer, there's a story that the wife of the man who started AA got very angry at one point at him and all of his AA meetings and all of that fellowship he was having that was cutting into her time with him. And she got real mad and she threw a shoe. She threw a shoe. It sounds so tame, almost boring today, but I'm sure it was traumatic for her. So here's my shoe throwing moment. We had these great two little pugs. They were just the best. And we would walk all over town, go to Central Park with them. It was great. But he had lost another job, and I was going down to Petco to buy dog food. And oh, look, I have 18 minutes left. I'll never get to the recovery part. Maybe I will. This is it. This is it. I got so mad about having to buy this bag of dog food. And that's when the light switch went off in my head. And I said, damn it. I'm going to Al-Anon. I don't need it. But if I go to it, he'll see how bad I have it. I have to sit in the church basement under fluorescent light for an hour and a half with total strangers because of him. He'll see. And so I did that. I did have a little secret agenda because I had been trying to cure him of alcoholism, because you know me from childhood, I'm supposed to be able to heal people. And so in my quest to heal him of his disease, I found a book by a doctor, and it was on pharmaceutical approaches to treating addiction. But one sentence in that book said, AA is very successful at treating alcoholism. And one reason why is that the sense of safety that members feel in the group actually rebalances levels of dopamine and serotonin in the brain. And when I read that, I thought, damn, I would like some of that. I would like some chemical balancing in my brain. And I don't qualify for AA, but I qualify for Al-Anon, and maybe I'll get it secondhand. So I find a meeting down the street. I walk into this meeting. The meetings in New York have names. Well, like we got 7 o'clock, let's rock, right? So the name of the meeting I walked into was Work the Program, Not the Problem. That alone, I think, is like earth-shaking retooling of the way my brain works. Work the program, not the problem. It took years, but I saw I like to work the problem, work it and rework it, and turn it over in my head 120 times. And they're telling me to do something that's completely different, that makes no sense. So I came in. And there was a woman named Rosemary. I call her the Oracle, because she would spout these things out and they would just floor me. And the first thing she said, some of you have heard this in other meetings, she said, what somebody else thinks of me is none of my business. And I thought, wait, no, that's wrong. Because I was all about managing your opinion of me. And really, I was trying to manage my opinion of me too. And I was failing miserably, but I really thought it was up to me. So I heard that and I thought, that can't be right. But here's the thing. I thought, this is where God got in, just a little sliver. I thought, it doesn't sound right, but damn, if it were right, it'd be really cool. It'd be really cool not to be obsessing about your opinion of me. So just this little ray of light came in. And then she said, Al-Anon is a program of self-acceptance, not self-improvement. And the same thing. I thought, hey, that's no good. I have at least three full shelves of self-help books at home that are showing me how to improve myself so that I can function better in the world and feel like I'm worth something. And that's step one for me. I realized, and I still need to remind myself sometimes today, I still fall into this idea that, yes, I've read probably 40 or 50 self-help books, and some of them are really good and a lot of them are crap. But there might be, it's so much like an addiction, there might be just one more of those books that I haven't found at Barnes & Noble yet that's going to say something brilliant that's going to save me. Anyway, she said that. These are other useful things she said. She said, if you're having trouble with a step, try stepping back. And that's helped me. That still helps me, because sometimes I find myself trying to turn something over to a power greater than myself. But I haven't gone back to that step one experience, which is, for me, step one is painful, but so comforting all at the same time. When I admit that I can't fix me or the disease or the alcoholic or what alcoholism has done to me, I cannot fix those with my intellect backed by will. So that was smart that she said. And then she said, if you feel like you're spinning and things are going out of control, ask yourself four questions. Who is my sponsor? What step am I on? What service am I doing? And what is my home group? If you can answer those four questions, it's quite possible that you're actually in better shape than you realize. And for me, that was great. That was working the program and not the problem. You know, I'm all about trying to boost my self-esteem. Well, guess what? I don't know how to do it. I don't know how I got this way, and I don't know how to fix it. And when I think I can fix it, I get in a bad loop. But step one gives me this permission to say, damn, I've been trying to fix this inner brokenness, maybe I could call it that. I've been trying to fix this inner brokenness for decades, and I really, really, really have failed when I've just used my willpower and my intellect. And you know, it makes me sad to admit that and recognize it, but it also is, it's comforting because it's only what, for me, it's only when I do that, that a space opens up for something greater than me to come in that I don't necessarily understand. Anyway, so that was my entry into Al-Anon. I found a sponsor pretty quickly, great guy. We would meet at the diner near the church where the meeting was before the meeting at noon or around noon. We would have lunch and then go to the meeting Saturday afternoon. That's when he introduced me to that line I was quoting to you before. We truly believed that our intellect backed by will was sufficient to rightly guide our inner lives and guarantee a success in the world. And then another AA line about step one that I love is, who cares to admit complete defeat? I love this one. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one. Every human instinct cries out against the admission of personal powerlessness. I love that because it helps me forgive myself for my resistance to surrendering. So about a month or two after I got into Al-Anon, I got very sick. I didn't know how sick I was, but I was sick and I had a bad lung thing going on. And I was afraid to go to the doctor. And I had a friend named Elaine who wasn't in Al-Anon, but she was a very good friend. And she knew I'd been going there. And she said, well, aren't you going to Al-Anon now? And I said, yeah. And she says, well, don't you have a sponsor? And I said, yeah. And she says, well, why don't you call him and ask him to go with you to the doctor? So I did. And he said, what's the address and what time? I'll be there. And I ended up in the hospital, but I knew I was going to be okay because the doctor who admitted me told me that although I had cut it pretty close, this course of IV antibiotics was going to work and I would be okay. So my fear was taken away. But here's the thing. I'd been in Al-Anon a month or two. I didn't know those people in that room. I didn't know them. But they loved me. I didn't even know they loved me. Maybe they didn't even know they loved me, but they did. And I had company at that hospital when I was being nursed back to health. And that was something I'd never had before. So let's see. Oh, I have time. That's my entry into the program. I stayed in that relationship for a number of years. And then some career stuff led me back out to LA. I went to LA temporarily, but I decided to stay. And I'm going to tell you the truth. I decided to stay because it was my apartment back in New York. I mean, I had the lease was in my name. Some of you probably know, having your own apartment, having a lease in Manhattan is no small thing. It's not something you want to let go of lightly. But I didn't have it in me to break up with Tears with Mr. T. So I moved. I moved to LA partly to pursue some career opportunities, but also to separate from a person that I loved dearly, but knew was dragging me down. The relationship was dragging me down, probably both of us. I thought he would perish without me. So for my first year back in LA, I kept paying his cable bill because I knew how much he liked TV and he loved Judy Garland. And it seemed that was like his church was watching Judy Garland videos. And I thought, well, I couldn't live with myself knowing that he didn't have television. So I paid that cable bill for a year. And I was starting Alan on here. I was in the Studio City Lunch Bunch meeting on Mondays. And they convinced me that it might be good to stop paying the cable bill. And so I did. Here's the thing. Mr. T was always having financial trouble, always. And I was always resentfully helping him out. But here's the kicker. When I left Manhattan, he started to thrive financially. He started a dog walking business on the block, and it mushroomed. It was just like huge. He didn't need me in that way. He did not need me in that way. And that was humbling, but also, damn, what a relief. What a relief. But shoot, you know, that feeling of feeling indispensable was a big part of my Al-Anon disease. I would say my mother helped me develop that. She was always emotionally distraught. And it was always up to me to make her feel a little more level, to offset and compensate for the fighting she was experiencing from my dad and from my sister. So that's what happened to me with alcoholism. I got this overgrown sense of my indispensability to others. And it felt good in a way. I didn't have an awareness of how it was killing me. I only knew it felt good in some way to be indispensable to someone. Anyway, I came back here and I got into Al-Anon in LA. I was living at my mom's house for my first year back in LA, and she was in Woodland Hills. So I started going to the Saturday morning meeting there. At first, I was driving over the hill because I said, oh, there can't be good meetings in the valley. I have to go to meetings in Santa Monica. That's where the good meetings will be. So I was driving all over this town going to meetings because I didn't think anything near me would be any good. But I finally, I forget why, I went to the one nearby. It was the best meeting I ever went to. There were 100 women in there. They all were wearing pink jumpsuits and had blonde hair. And I loved them, and they loved me. They loved me. I haven't talked about the steps. Well, we talked about step one and two. Anyway, they loved me. My mom passed away a few years after that. I was a mess. It hit me 20 times harder than I ever thought it would. I went to that meeting. I was so shaken and so I could barely see. And two of the women, Renee and Ginny, they came up to me after that meeting and they didn't see, here's the great thing about Al-Anon. We don't fix each other. We hang with each other and let God do the fixing. So they came up to me and they said, well, They knew what I'd been through. They said, "We're going to go out shopping. We're going to go out shopping for yarn after the meeting, because they liked knitting, right? We're going to go out shopping for yarn after the meeting. Would you like to come along?" And I said, "Sure." "Yarn?" And I said, "Sure," because you know what? I trusted them enough. I knew them by then a little bit. And we went down to Ventura Boulevard and we stopped somewhere and got some soup. I remember it was this amazingly nurturing, comforting soup. And then we went down the boulevard and went to this yarn store. Well, I don't knit. I'm not into yarn, but I've always liked colors. I used to go to Macy's and sit in the towel department and look at on the wall. They had all the colors of towels on display, like a carousel. And I love that. So I sat in that yarn store and I just started tripping on the colors. And they were just so kind to me. But again, I'm repeating myself, but what was so beautiful about what they did and said was they knew they couldn't fix me and they didn't want to. And that was better than if they could fix. I'd always looking for the fix, right? Always looking for the magic pill. The missing puzzle piece, as my late sponsor said. He passed away this week, and it's rough. I'll just tell you, but I'm full of love for him. He used to talk about always looking for the missing puzzle piece. They didn't try to give me the missing puzzle piece. They just wanted to be with me. I see now, I didn't even see it then, but I can see now with some perspective of time, that that's one of the things that alcoholism robs you of when you're a kid. You get robbed of the experience of someone sitting with you. So what happens when Al-Anon comes into your life? You go into a room, and yes, the lights might be fluorescent, and yes, it might be in a basement, and there might be no windows, Nevertheless, you go and you sit next to people who are not trying to fix you. I think what's miraculous, they say, don't leave before the miracle. And for me, the miracle is recognizing that I need you. And that's why, you know, there's this corny line in our introductory, or maybe it's in the closing. Yes, in the closing, though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way. God, I hated that line for about a decade or two. It just sounded so flowery and corny and phony, to tell you the truth. That was just my defense against love. That's really why I had that response. I have a defense against love. The very thing I most need is the very thing I do not want. And so, the reason I love you in a very special way, it's kind of selfish. I love you in a special way because I know I need your company, because I can't see myself. I can't see myself. I need you to help me see myself. And I hope that I return the favor. Oh, wow, are you serious? Great. Let me set mine on this side so I know what's going on. Hold on, bear with me. Okay. So yeah, I think we say God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. I wanted my life to be a solo act. I still do a lot. I'm single. I'm a loner. But I wanted to feel better, but I wanted to do it by myself. And I was willing to come to Al-Anon, but I wasn't really willing to let you be a part of my finding myself and my learning to open up to the possibility of a life with a lot less inner angst and pain. I didn't want your help. I didn't want to need your help. But this is a fellowship. This is a fellowship. And just like that book said, if I want my dopamine and serotonin levels to balance out, I need to experience the safety of being in this group. And that's what I've gotten. I heard a great definition, or I heard a great clarification of what safety means recently. Someone was saying that the experience of safety is a human need that's as core and necessary and primal as food and water. But, excuse me, a lot of us think safety means the absence of threat. If there's no threat, then I'm safe. But safety, actually, I heard this one person say, take it or leave it. It's just it's one person's opinion. Safety is the experience of connection with others. Or you could say it's being in the herd. I didn't want to be in the herd. I didn't realize that the safest place for me was in the center of the herd. I wanted to be on the outside because I didn't want to feel the vulnerability of needing you to be okay. I don't need you for me to be okay in the sense of I need you to make me okay. I just need to be with you. I need to be in connection. That's 22 or 3 years now that I've been coming. I can tell you that I didn't use all of those years in the most productive way. I discovered that some of the steps I could use to harm myself more if I approached them without an awareness of my own harshness towards myself. So I can tell you that I did one or two fourth steps that really weren't helpful for me because I thought step four was all about really getting down to what's wrong with me. And I was already an expert on what was wrong with me when I came into Al-Anon. So I didn't know that. But through loving sponsorship, and I would say patient sponsorship, nobody tried to force me to change my mind. Same thing with sponsorship. My sponsor just showed up for me. I had coffee with my sponsor every week for I think 20 years with a little bit of a break during the pandemic. And, my sponsor said a lot of deep, important, insightful, helpful things. But when I look back on it, it's the same thing as with the meetings. What really heals me is the experience of together with coffee or not. And it's just, there's this invisible thing that happens. That's not about, it's not about insight, and it's not about, it's not mental. It's felt. I feel it in my body more than anything else. I've gotten so much from this program. And I continue, tomorrow I'm going to get up and that self-hatred will be there. Here's the deal. Oh, I'm so glad I remembered to tell you this. I thought it was my mission to learn to love myself as a person. Alcoholism took that from me. And I thought it was my job to fix that. And today, it's not so much I love myself. I don't know if I ever will love myself. Thank you. I don't know if I ever will, but here's what's happened. Step one happened. I stopped trying. I stopped trying to do this thing that sounded so important and so noble and so healthy. I think that's where we get tripped up a lot, is we get on our Al-Anon high horse, not because we're assholes, but because we think we're doing something really good. If we're trying to fix our spouse or our daughter or parent or whatever, I don't think we do it because we're horrible. We do it because we just don't get, it feels so noble. And so when I stopped trying to love myself, that opened a door. And that's enough for me today. And that allows for a power greater than myself to enter and to be the source of my well-being. Oh, I so didn't want to turn over my, you know, that's step three says we turn over our will and our lives. And for me, it's like turning over my well-being. I don't want to give that to anyone else. Certainly not to a higher power that I'm not even sure what or who it is. But step one comes around and says, yeah, but have you succeeded? Let's just look at this. Have you succeeded? And the truth is, no, I haven't. And so when I get to admit that defeat, I get to go through a step two experience of, well, I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever believe in a power greater than myself, but I have become willing to imagine a loving power who has me in his arms and cares for my well-being passionately. David, our old friend David Kay, we don't see anymore. He used to say, God has my picture on his refrigerator. I thought that was pretty cool. And then step three comes along and it's like, well, I guess I am going to give this guy. I rewrote step three for myself to help me with it. So my rewritten step three, just for me, I'm not trying to rock the boat, is having exhausted all other options, we finally decided to give this God thing a try. That's my step three. And I get to do it, but I can't do it until I really am clear that I've run out of options and that there is no book on Amazon or elsewhere that's gonna do it. Oh, there's Al-Anon literature for sure. But I mean, there's no trick of the mind that's out there that I have to find. Step four took me a long time. My sponsor said over and over again, put yourself at the top. Oh, well, that's more getting onto step eight, but I did a list of resentments as part of my step four process. And he just kept saying, put yourself at the top, put yourself at the top. And it took me a long time to realize that step four for me as an Al-Anon is about finding my good qualities, as well as those that maybe aren't serving me so well. I learned from sponsees all the time. I learned from a sponsee that it's not necessarily so much about the good qualities and the bad. It's more about realizing that everything is has been an adaptation to a disease called alcoholism. And even those that look bad served me in some way. That just reminds me, while the seconds are ticking away, I'm going to read you my favorite. I love Courage to Change. Got it. This is going to work. I love Courage to Change because it's got so much outside literature in it. You know, we don't usually get to read outside literature, but almost every page of this book has a quote from outside literature. And I love the ecumenical nature of that. So here's February 23rd. At the bottom of the page, here's the outside literature. It's from Mahatma Gandhi. My imperfections and failures are as much a blessing from God as my successes and my talents. And I lay them both at his feet. Self-hatred, it's as much a blessing from God as self-love. And I lay it at his feet. I can't fix it. That's the bottom line. Thank you for letting me share. I do love to talk, but I did keep my eyes on your beautiful faces, and I'm really glad. Thanks.